Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all with us. Reminding you that support for WEAA is provided by KIDA. Here you are, the Mark Steiner Show here, and Soundbites you're listening to are a weekly look at the food system and the future of our food system in America. You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA FM, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and at Delmarva Public Radio on the eastern shore of Maryland. As well. So that's Delmarva Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM in our weekly look at the food system. In this first part of our program, we're going to look at how this government shutdown is affecting the lives of people in America when it comes to our food, both food safety and access to food. We are joined by Tim Murphy, reporter for the Mother Jones magazine in Washington, D.C., at the Washington, D.C. Bureau. Tim, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me.
Michael J. Wilson is once again in the studio, director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. Michael, good to have you in the studio
as
well.
Glad to be back, Mark. My pleasure.
And you all are with us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow at gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages, Mark Steiner Show and Mark Steiner. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join this conversation. So I think we don't think about how this affects. One of the things that struck me the most, Tim Murphy, is as I was reading this, there are a lot of people here who don't want to eat red meat, so they like to eat inexpensive seafood. And one of the ways people buy inexpensive seafood, let's say, is to buy shrimp. People buy shrimp in all ways, all kinds of ways. But that now we have a situation where 90% of the shrimp that people comes through is going to come through unchecked from the Food and Drug Administration because inspectors have been furloughed, the same with fruit and vegetables. Tim? Go ahead. Wax forth a bit.
Seafood is kind of a particularly dicey area and something particularly vulnerable in the case of a shutdown because we don't really monitor that much of it to begin with, and that's obviously a major problem. But with kind of the shutdowns at the FDA and the USDA, now it's essentially all kind of coming into the country totally unmonitored. What we're seeing is that, we have foodborne illnesses that, we have agencies that are normally tasked, with monitoring and kind of intervening as needed and performing random inspections, and they just kind of totally lack the infrastructure to do that. So we have, right now there's a salmonella outbreak, which is the type of thing that, the Center for Disease Control exists to monitor, and they just don't have the resources to really effectively intervene.
So I think that this is a shutdown. So when we're looking at food safety issues in this country, they are really kind of very serious because what we're looking at here is that different food systems have been blocked because of tainted foods that you had. This is interesting. You have these terms that people that we don't really hear. They look for filthiness, which means excrement in our foods. Nobody's going to be doing that. Foods covered in pesticides. Drugged, dope seafood, that will no longer be tested. Even in the small amounts, dairy products with melamine will not be tested. Dietary supplements that might have mad cow disease and E. coli will not be tested. Candy laced with lead that has been stopped from coming in, that will no longer be tested. I mean, these are things that we are going to be, that the government shut down. We're not even thinking about what it means to lay off 70% of the workers at FDA, that their work is no longer essential.
Yeah, and if you look at literally every step in the process of kind of, growing your food to consuming your food and that entire long chain, everything is affected. So, pesticides. Pesticides are not being monitored right now by the Environmental Protection Agency. That's bad for your food. That's also bad for the people who are growing your food. The pigs that you eat. Well, right now the National Animal Health Laboratory Network is shut down because of the shutdown. So they're not monitoring your pigs. The USDA and the CDC aren't looking at the stockyards and things like that. The hotline that the USDA sets up for people to have questions about, how to properly cook their food and consume their food is shut down. And then, of course, at the consumer end, you're not able to get food assistance. You're not able to get a paycheck. You're not able to kind of properly, balance your diet and things like that. So it's really the entire food system has been, thrown for a loop here.
Michael, how do you see this shutdown affecting us? In a very different way, I think, in some ways.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that the things he's talking about are extremely important, but it's the way that the shutdown impacts people differently. And so, you know, excrement in the food, pesticide in the site in the food is the stuff that really makes middle-class consumers very unhappy and unhappy about the shutdown. When we talk about food programs, you know, it's people who are in poverty, who are poor people, who are used to dealing with the government not giving them a fair shake. And so everything that we try to work on to make sure that people can actually access food and not live in hunger is threatened by the shutdown. So the thing that's most immediately impacted is the Women's Infants and Children Program, WIC, which does not guarantee to have funding throughout the entire month of October, much less in November. So this is clearly a policy, to use an old phrase, you know, women and children first. I mean, these are the folks who are going to be impacted.
And 45% of all newborn children, all newborns in America, are in WIC.
That's correct.
45% of all newborns are in WIC.
Right. So depending on where you are in the country or even in the state of Maryland, depending on where the grants came or when they got them, people may not have access to WIC in a matter of weeks or less. And so getting the shutdown fix for those folks is critical. It means a lot in terms of their development, their ability to be able to provide for their kids and for themselves. It's a real challenge.
And we're seeing across the country where I was reading an article about what's going on in Texas, and it's happening just across America, where the millions of dollars worth of food coming in to food banks in North Dallas are no longer coming because the shipments have been stopped and because there's no way to transport them. We're talking about the food coming from the federal government.
Right, right. So the other problem that we'll see in Maryland, where we have so many federal workers, are these are the folks who are part of the community, who traditionally give to the food banks, who are the donors, who, given the uncertainty of the shutdown, are probably less likely to give and more likely to be looking to receive. We saw the big jump in the unemployment numbers, 15,000 for Maryland in the last week, which is tremendous. So the challenge is huge. In addition to this, food stamps, the SNAP program, known in Maryland as FSP, has got funds throughout the end of October. That's not going to be a problem. If you go to your local grocery store and use your EBT card, you'll be able to access your benefits. Beyond October, however, that's not guaranteed. And so,
wait, were you saying in SNAP?
In SNAP, that's correct.
Why is it not guaranteed? Because there's nobody to be able to.
Because there's no appropriated funds for the food stamp program. They can't guarantee that it's.
Thought that, like, Social Security was being held separate. No?
No, that's not quite correct. That's correct. Not quite correct. Yeah. Food stamps are not going to be guaranteed in November if they haven't figured out how to deal with the appropriations.
There was a woman, Jennifer McCready, who is a single mom in Chestertown, Pennsylvania, who's in WIC, and she said that, I am still fearful. I keep thinking to myself, should I go and cash all these checks? Should I load up on groceries so I'm covered? She was being interviewed by Time magazine. There is no way I would have been able to afford formula for my child without WIC. I think women who depend on WIC for formula will be hurt the most. People don't realize that's exactly what goes on here.
Yeah.
Women, especially people in WIC who might not be able to breastfeed all the time, need to get infant formula to supplement the breast milk they have or to use it instead. And people like Jennifer McCready in Chestertown, in Maryland, are threatened by this.
Right. And the basic part of that is if you are breastfeeding, which we know is a good thing, you need to make sure you have good, healthy food for yourself in order to be able to develop everything you need for the kid. Just to go back to food stamps for a second, the authority to make the October benefits came from the Recovery Act of 2009,
right.
And Congress provided such sums as necessary. There's some contingency funding that may be available and could be used, but there's no guarantee as we go on, as the shutdown continues. This is not guaranteed. Similarly, with the school lunch program, you know, kids are used to going to school. You know, most school funding is local or state funding. There's some federal funding in schools. But the school lunch program, beyond October, given the October 1st cutoff, school lunches are going to be potentially problematic as well.
So go ahead, Tim.
I would just add one more area in which this comes up, which is Head Start, which provides a lot of nutrition assistance for small children. And that was on the chopping block up until yesterday when a bunch of donors came forward with $10 million to, you know, sort of temporarily keep Head Start running across the country. But, you know, obviously that's a stopgap solution. And, you know, if they enshrine the cuts of sequestration in whatever continuing budget they pass, you know, Head Start and the kids who use it are going to be affected as well.
So, I mean, what did you say about the $10 million? It was private donors that did this?
Yeah, they stepped forward, you know, to their credit. A lot of times you hear people talk about, well, this could just be filled by, you know, private donors, and it really can't.
But kindness of their hearts.
In a short-term solution, you know, it might work.
So, Tim, let me just jump back to you again before we go to the phones here and get to Leo, our first caller, up at 410-319-8888 here on Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show. So what do you see the looming on the horizon, Tim, when it comes to shutdown that would affect the kind of things we're talking about if things are not resolved in the next month?
You know, right now they're you can't really see the horizon. You know, I think the shift in Washington, there's been a shift away from really talking about the shutdown to talking about the debt ceiling debate and, you know, the idea, I guess, of tying these two to, you know, together and just coming up with a solution at once. But the debt ceiling won't be reached until October 17th, according to the Secretary of the Treasury. So that still gives us 9 days. There isn't, you know, there's no immediate solution on the table. I wouldn't be surprised if we get through the end of another week without any sort of fix. And, you know, like I said, the fix that would be put in place would just keep funding at the levels that they were for the last year, which was already a 5% cut and was, you know, really a devastating blow to Head Start programs and, you know, a lot of programs that serve low-income people.
In addition to that, because they're going to let the ERA boost, the boost that they had for food stamps because of the recession, is going to go away on November the 1st. So people who get food stamps, if the average in Maryland is $30 a month, it's going to go down automatically, even if they do the appropriations. So people are going to get less. It's going to be a hard time going forward.
That's an important number to say. How much did you say a month?
$30 a month is the average in Maryland that a food stamp recipient gets.
410-319-8888. Join us here on Soundbites here on the Mark Steiner Show with your thoughts and as we look at how the government shutdown will affect food programs in this country. Leo, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning. Mark Steiner, my friend.
Good morning, Leo Burrows. How are you?
I am marvelous. I'm listening to your guests, and it makes me very angry, very methodical. And I'll tell you, by the end of this week, if we don't have some changes here of any substance, Boehner will not allow a vote to go forward. That's what he's saying at this point in the Congress. We need to be engaged in well-organized civil disobedience in this country. Now, I don't want the government to fall, but there's something very sinister, Mark, and guests and everybody, that's going on here. I think this goes beyond affordable health care and all of that. I think the insurgents, and I'm going to call these Republicans and some of their Democratic supporters as insurgents, they want to radically change the direction of this country. And that means if they have to use force of arms to do it with the support of the militias that many of these people represent. We got more militias, Mark, now in this country than we've ever had. And so I'm very fearful of what may happen. And I'm saying this not in terms of being panicked by it, but in the realization that the people who want to excommunicate the president of the United States, Boehner wants to be president, and he's not going to happen. But they hate this man, Barack Obama, and they hate the black and the poor, and they don't really give a damn about the middle class. So I'm saying if we don't get some kind of direct action from the National Council of Churches or the fraternities and sororities and community organizations, this is not a game that we can afford to continue to act as if we're spectators. You know, this is not a spectator sport. You're going to have to force a resolution on behalf of the working poor and the black and others who are disenfranchised in this country. And if folks aren't willing to do that, they got to understand that this could be the diary of Anne Frank for real for people in this country. We might find that this is a fascist effort to take over control of this government.
Leo, I appreciate the call, and I look forward to you joining us some more this week as we really wrestle with that larger issue coming up in the coming days here on the show with the shutdown and where it could lead us and why there's such a deep divide in America, which we wrestled with on the program yesterday in our first hour. And I think that we're seeing the results of this. One of the things that was written in is that so if you're one of the tens of thousands of vendors that rely on the Food and Drug Administration's Red Alert, and the Red Alert being to keep track of companies and shipment sources with bad track records. So if you're one of those, this is written in, for anything from excrement-laden produce to dietary supplements also containing mad cow disease, this is your chance to sell the United States. Got lead and candy? Come on in, writes one of our listeners. And I think that's maybe extreme today, but Tim Murphy, not so extreme if we don't get this back on track.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things about the shutdown is that it sort of forces people, you know, to realize that they actually rely on the federal government for a lot of things, whether or not they appreciate that on a day-to-day basis. So you might not go to the national parks, you might not come to Washington, D.C., but you generally eat salad, or at least you should. And, you know, if there's excrement on that salad, if there's, you know, bacteria, if there's disease in your meat that you eat, you know, that's eventually going to come back to bite you, or if not you, somebody you know, or, you know, a sizable enough community, and it's going to have, you know, real damage, and you're going to start to realize that maybe this thing that we call the USDA really should get funded on a year-to-year basis.
And I mean, coming back, Michael, again, to kind of round this out a little bit, especially when it comes to the poor and what you are, what are your greatest fears? And you and your colleagues, you're around the country where things might even be more dire in certain communities in Mississippi and Texas and the South.
So we were actually, I was at a meeting last week with the hunger leaders from around the country, and it happened to be that we met the day after the shutdown. And so, yeah, there were folks there from Mississippi and from California and from Utah and from Maine. We're all comparing things that are going on. I mean, I think here's the easiest number to kind of for people to kind of think about. The $40 billion cuts in SNAP that the House has already approved, that $40 billion cut, there's no way food banks can make that up. Food banks did about $1 billion worth of food around the country. So that $40 billion over a 10-year period is $4 billion a year. So food banks, if you believe the rhetoric that volunteerism and charity should do this instead of the government, food banks would have to do about four times what they already do. And all of them tell us there's no way they can possibly do that. I mean, how do we feed people? How do people get fed? How do people deal with hunger in a situation where there's no solution? And that's my greatest fear.
It is huge fear, and I think that what we'll have to do here on Soundbites, the Mark Steiner Show, as the shutdown continues, if it does continue, especially in the weeks ahead, if it's not resolved, then we'll continue our watch on what happens to food in America and farming in America with this shutdown, how it affects what poor people, how it affects poor people, how it affects middle class and work people in America, just in terms of what will no longer be happening and the money's being cut. And so I want to thank both of my guests this hour. Tim Murphy will join us by phone from Washington, D.C., where he is reporter with Mother Jones magazine. Tim, always great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael J. Wilson in the studio, director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. Always great to see you, Michael.
Good to be back.
Thanks for the work that you do. We're going to have a very brief break here on Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show. When we come back, we'll be joined by Keith Nachman to look at a new ruling that is actually maybe taking the arsenic out of our chicken. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back here to Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show. You're listening to here on 88.9 FM, WEAA, the voice of the community in Delmarva Public Radio at WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. We continue our conversations here. We're once again joined by Keith Nachman. Keith Nachman is the director of the Center for Livable Futures, Farming for the Future program, and co-author of the report on arsenic-based chicken drugs used in chickens raised and sold here in the United States of America. And Keith, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Good. Good to hear your voice.
Thank you.
So, Keith, talk a bit about this new ruling and what it means. Have you won the fight about arsenic in chicken?
Well, maybe in part. We're very excited. So, you know, as you mentioned, back in May, we published a study that showed that using Roxersone, which is an arsenic-based drug, increases the amount of toxic arsenic in chicken meat. And the FDA was finally ordered by a court to respond to a petition that dated back a couple of years ago that demanded it withdraw the approvals or ban arsenic-based drugs from poultry production. So there are four poultry drugs that contain arsenic that are approved for use in chickens, and FDA withdrew three of them, which we're very, very excited about. In Maryland, we were actually ahead of the curve, and we had already passed a law that banned the use of those three drugs in the past, but this has big implications for the rest of the country where those drugs can no longer legally be used.
So, I mean, but what does it mean for those of us buying chicken right now?
For those of us buying chicken, it's no real change, but we are. No real Maryland
change?
Law has already been responsible for that change in the past anyway.
So, what do you mean, no real change?
Well, those drugs can't be used in Maryland with the exception of Nitrazone, and FDA withdrawing the approval of those drugs really has bigger implications for the rest of the country where they don't have the same law that we do that would prohibit the use of those drugs.
So, but if you're a listener from Virginia or from Delaware, how does it affect them?
Well, it means that these drugs can no longer come back on the market, and they can no longer be used in chickens, with the exception, of course, of Nitrazone, which is the fourth drug that FDA didn't act on.
Talk about that drug for a moment.
So Nitrazone is a drug that the turkey industry openly admits to routinely using, and that drug is used to treat a parasite that impacts the intestine and the liver of turkeys and causes something called blackhead disease. And that one's staying on the market. FDA has decided that even though there's very clear evidence for Roxersone increasing the amount of arsenic in meat, they haven't made the same determination about Nitrazone.
And why do you think that is?
Well, no one's studied it. No one's done the study like we did in chicken meat with Roxersone, and so it remains to be seen whether or not the lessons we learned from our study would apply in turkey meat.
So is that are you going to do that study?
We're certainly thinking about it.
Because are you saying that means we're not sure what that drug does?
I think we can draw some pretty strong inferences from what we did in chickens, but we can't say with absolute certainty that the same thing happens in turkeys. It likely does. So I think a very short, quick study could probably answer that question for us and allow FDA to make the right decision. But they're very reluctant to do so. They don't like pulling animal drugs off the market. It's not a common occurrence. The number of times they've withdrawn the approval for an animal drug, you can count them on one hand.
So and why do you think that is? Because why do you think it's so difficult to do?
Well, they've already done a study to make a decision, and they like to stick by that decision. But unfortunately, in the case of a lot of animal drugs, they've made that decision decades ago. In Roxersone, for example, or all these arsenic-based drugs, these drugs were approved in the 1940s. So, the science that we had available to us at the time didn't allow us to determine the real public health consequences of the drug in the same way that the tools we have available to us now allow us to do. So, you know, by those standards, it may have been okay, but now we know it's not okay. And they often aren't funded to go back and revisit the safety of drugs, and so they don't do it.
Because I remember the arguments, the debates we had on this program around that, and some of the debates were that arsenic is found in the everyday environment, that it's not something that's dangerous. And that was clearly some of the industry kind of arguments in these debates. So what happens to arguments like that now, especially when you're talking about the other additives that you're going to be looking at?
Lots of things occur naturally in the environment that aren't good for us, and we don't want to be exposed to them any more than we have to. And using these drugs increases people's exposure. So, it's very clear when you don't have to use the drug that you shouldn't.
So what are the next steps? When I was reading this, given all the stuff we've talked about over the last couple of years here on Soundbites in our debates from both sides on on arsenic. It seemed to me that given this kind of ban on both poultry and pig feeds, this is a major step.
This is a major step. This is really a nail in the coffin for Roxurson, and that's big because historically that's been the most common arsenic-based drug, and it actually has international implications. So there's a concern that in countries that are developing that may not have the infrastructure to do their own drug safety evaluations, they rely on American drug approvals to make their own decisions. And now that these drugs are no longer approved in the States, it's likely that other countries that may consider using them will choose not to now. So that's pretty big, you know. And I think, you know, we've set our laser sights now on nitazone. That's the last remaining arsenical drug that's being used. The turkey industry is very open about using it, and I think we know where to look and what to look for. So we'll see what happens next with that one.
I mean, I think that one of the big issues here. Well, before we end this, let me do this. I'm going to ask you to stay with us for a couple minutes right after the break for
okay.
One or two more questions on arsenic and our chicken and where this leads us, and then we'll move into the talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and how that affects food and farming in our country coming up after that. So stay with us here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show here and Soundbites. That's where every week here, Tuesday morning, we have Soundbites. You're listening here at WEAFM, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community here out of Baltimore, Maryland, and on Marvel Public Radio, WSTL, 90.7 FM, and WSTL, 89.5 FM. And on our way back, reminding you also, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Money comes back in the end, and it belongs to you. More information at www.mecu.com, or you can log on to the steinershow.org website and click on their banner, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Continuing here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our conversations, to conclude our conversation about the latest rulings on arsenic and chicken feed with Keith Nachman, director of the Center for Livable Futures Farming for the Future program and co-author of a report on arsenic-based drugs used in chickens. Two final things I just want to clear before we run to our next subject and start looking at the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There's not much in the news and how that's affecting food and farming here in America and the world. One of the things that the folks who made these things, like Zoetis, thank you very much for mm-hmm. the correction, saying it was off the market anyway, but now this means that the FDA is legally withdrawing their ability to market these drugs at any time.
Right.
Right?
Yes, they can no longer bring it back to the market.
And I think the other part of this was, I was interested when I was reading this report, to get a sense of how this affects the food chain. When we do things like have different additives in feed for pigs and chickens, that the Consumer Reports article about the arsenic levels in rice that we covered once with them, about how this kind of it goes beyond the chickens, it goes into the entire food chain and our ecosystem.
Absolutely. So, you know, a couple of outputs from chicken production that you might not think about. So we raise a lot of chickens on the eastern shore of the Delmarva Peninsula. We do about 600 million chickens a year. And those chickens produce an enormous amount of waste. And when you feed chickens arsenic-based drugs, a good fraction of the drug ends up in that chicken waste and in the manure. And when we apply it to agricultural land as fertilizer, it's loaded with arsenic, very, very high levels of arsenic. And then we use that manure to grow crops. And certain types of crops are really, really good at pulling arsenic out of soil and out of manure, and rice is a perfect example of that. In fact, there was a lawsuit from the Arkansas rice industry against Pfizer, who controls Zoetis, over Roxurson. They were implicating Pfizer's production and the subsequent use of Roxurson in the arsenic levels that were seen in rice products that kind of came to light through the Consumer Reports work. So, you know, the arsenic doesn't stay put. It doesn't entirely end up in the chickens. It goes lots of different places. And there's absolutely concerns over chicken manure that can contaminate surface waters and potentially groundwaters carrying arsenic with it. and adding to the arsenic content of those waters as well. So, you know, it's in aggregate, if you think about the number of animals we produce, if we were to use those drugs, there'd be an enormous environmental contribution of arsenic on an annual basis.
Keith Nachman is director for the Center for a Livable Futures, Farming for the Future program, and co-author of the report on arsenic-based drugs used in chickens that we've been covering a great deal since the report came out, from their perspective of the industry and farmers and others, and kind of concluding with now, not concluding, there's much more to talk about in the coming months and years, but with the new new ban on allowing arsenic in animal feed from the FDA and how that affects the future. So, Keith, great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Always great to be here. Thanks, Mark.
We're going to take a very brief break here on Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show. In about 30 seconds, come right back and jump into our conversation about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Don't go away. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. Welcome back. We are about to have a conversation on something we don't hear a lot about in the mainstream press, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We are joined by Darren Baxt. Did I say your last name correctly?
Yes, you did. Thanks,
good.
Mark. Good,
making sure. I don't like to mispronounce names. Darren Baxt is a research fellow in agricultural policy at the Heritage Foundation. In studio is Mitch Jones, director of the Common Resources Program at Food and Water Watch. And welcome to both of you. Good to have you both with us.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And inviting you all to join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at Steiner Show, S-T-E-I-N-E-R show.com. And you can also log on to our Facebook pages and tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So let, from both your perspectives, we don't hear a lot about this, but it's happening as we sit here.
Yes.
It does affect food and farming regulations in our country and across the globe. People
yes.
looking at this as kind of someone wrote in saying, you're going to do a show or something, I call it NAFTA on steroids. And I'm just curious your perspective, if you could define what all this means for our listeners, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, starting with you, Darren.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, I guess you could say it's NAFTA on steroids. It does have potential to be the largest U.S. free trade agreement, but that's a good thing. In terms, since we're focusing on agriculture, there are some key markets that would be able to have exports and to promote exports and create jobs for the U.S. In particular, there's Malaysia and Vietnam, where you got fast-growing countries, and we're not able to kind of get into those markets like we'd want to. Then there's a country like Japan, where we actually, it's a major export. We export a lot of agricultural products to Japan, but they have very high tariffs and restrictive quotas, so that makes it difficult. So if you have a trade agreement with these countries, which we don't have actually, it would make it much better for the United States to promote jobs and economic growth. So it's certainly should be focused on in that regard.
Ms. Jones, your analysis of what this TP is known as TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, means.
Right. Well, I think that basically what it really is it's not a trade deal. It's being sold as a trade deal, but a lot of what is being negotiated behind closed doors, let's keep this in mind, one of the reasons why we're not hearing a lot about it is because the negotiations are taking place in secret. A lot of what's being negotiated aren't just tariff lines. It's not just the reduction of tariffs and the opening of markets, but it's a lot of other issues. It has to do with environmental regulations, food safety regulations, worker safety regulations, and all the very various public health safeguards that we can set up domestically to protect ourselves are going to be potentially undermined by this deal. There's a good chance, for instance, that we're going to be forced, if the deal is approved, Darren mentioned Japan. Japan has just made a move to weaken its standard on mad cow disease, which you were talking about earlier in an earlier segment, moving the age at which cows will be tested up from 30 months to 48 months. meaning there's a whole new swath of cattle, the
cows that they raise in Japan.
That would now be being exported to the U.S. So there's a problem there that we'd be having with food safety potentially here in the U.S. There's a problem with the Australian food and, for that matter, the Canadian food safety inspection system model being imported into the U.S. The USDA is already trying to effectively privatize meat inspection in this country, as is being done in Australia and in Canada, and we believe that the TPP will be a gateway for allowing them to do that. But beyond that, to the point of opening markets and creating jobs, you know, we were told that when we did the Korea Free Trade Act that there would be 70,000 new jobs in the U.S. Instead, the Economic Policy Institute has found that we've lost 40,000 jobs. In terms of agriculture, since the Korea Free Trade Act was actually became law, we've seen a decrease in U.S. exports to Korea in beef and in poultry and in pork. So, you know, we've heard this before, that that these deals are going to create jobs and open markets. But what we actually see when we look after the deals are done is that the jobs don't materialize and the exports never really become what we've been told they're going to be. And in fact, in the case of Korea, all of those agricultural products dropped.
If I could
go ahead, please jump in Darren.
I mean, just briefly on the exports and then on kind of keep making distinguishing between this trade deal versus food safety. First of all, we look at NAFTA, agricultural exports to Canada and Mexico had tripled and quintupled, respectively, this NAFTA. So, been a boon for the U.S. and farmers and ranchers. So, from the ag side, it's been great. It's important to distinguish between this trade deal and food safety. Look, I'm all in favor of transparency, and to the extent that it needs to be better transparency as part of this trade agreement, that's fine. I would certainly agree with that. But Congress has the chance to review whatever comes out of any negotiations. So we'll know full well, the public will know what's actually part of the agreement. Plus, nothing is going to change when it comes to domestic regulation of food. We just passed a massive new law, or Congress did, and signed into law in 2011 by President Obama, called the Food Safety Modernization Act, and nothing is going to change in terms of weakening it as a result of the TPP. So the scare tactics and these attempts for protectionism just aren't going to work.
Well, the Food Safety Modernization Act was an FDA bill, not a USDA bill, so it has nothing to do with the program I was talking about.
That's fine. You're right. It is the FDA bill. I didn't say it was a USDA bill.
Right, but I was talking about USDA and meat inspection. So, you know, again, if you want to talk about NAFTA, there's another place where we were promised 200,000 jobs. Instead, if you look at the analysis, we've lost upwards of 700,000 jobs due to the NAFTA. If you take a look at the trade deficit in food products post-NAFTA, post-WTO, we actually go from having had a trade surplus in food products to a trade deficit. Now, in recent years, that has flipped again, but that is largely due to the fact that corn and wheat make up a large amount of the export that we do from the U.S. in food product, and corn and wheat prices have been unusually high. I mean, I think you and I, Mark, have talked about this before in 2007 and the impact that that had around the world. And so because of that increase in prices and because of the share of volume that those products make up, we've been able on a dollar basis to see an increase in food exports. But if you actually look at volume, the changes haven't been that great. And in point of fact, following the kind of rapid succession of NAFTA and then WTO, we actually went from a surplus into a deficit.
Okay, well, in agricultural products, which I think is the focus, the trade deficit, I mean, in terms of trade deficit, in 2011, we had a surplus of $2.6 billion. And then when we look at jobs, we want to look at net jobs, not just whether or not jobs lost or increased. Net jobs would be, about nearly 5 million of the jobs were supported by the increase in trade generated by NAFTA. So NAFTA is working fine. And right now, we shouldn't just be focusing on NAFTA. We should be focusing on, I think, the food safety implications of TTP and when honestly there is nothing.
Well, there are phone calls coming in. Ali and Joe are going to come to your calls in just a second. Yep. After I ask this quick question, that is part of the big issue here. I mean, one of the things that Japan and some Japanese papers are writing was the other side of that question. They were saying they're worried that this could the battle going in Japan is whether or not that this would affect their much more strict rules about pesticides and additives in Japanese foods than they have here in the United States, and how that will affect that. Other people are arguing that that the TPP would allow an override of national laws when it comes to food safety and the food we eat. Let's talk about that. How the rubber meets the road there. What is the reality? Is that real? Is it not real? Let's go first to Darren, then over to Mitch, and then we'll open the phones.
Look, international law doesn't trump domestic or sovereign law. Congress ultimately will have to pass implementing legislation that would make this possible. So if we actually want to somehow change our food safety system, Congress will have to do it. It's not going to be as a result of the negotiations. It ultimately will come back to Congress. And even if there is some type of mechanism in place where there's some type of enforcement mechanism that's like we have usually in any type of trade arrangement, like with WTO, the result might be a country might be able to retaliate in terms of tariffs or something along those lines. It's not like the U.S. actually has to abide by anything or actually even follow it. The idea is to have, if you're going to have some type of free trade agreement, you have to have some rules of the game.
Mitch?
I do think that there are a couple of key points. One is that we have seen that, Darren mentioned the WTO. We've seen things like, not exactly on the food safety front, but somewhat related. We've seen country of origin labeling attacked under the WTO. We've seen Dolphin-safe tuna labeling attacked under the WTO. We've seen bans on clove cigarettes attacked under the WTO. All of these things are actually popular here in the U.S., but they get attacked under the WTO. They're taken off to an international, unaccountable global trade tribunal to be determined instead of being determined here in the U.S. Under NAFTA, we're seeing on a slightly different issue, a lawsuit challenging Quebec's moratorium on fracking. So, and that's because of this investor-state equivalence, which one of your earlier guests mentioned as well, where foreign companies will be allowed to sue federal, state, and local governments if they feel that the laws and regulations of those governmental bodies here in the U.S. somehow undermine their rights under this free trade deal. And another issue with food safety isn't just the inspection regime. We also have to remember that a lot of the countries in TPP are exporters of seafood. It's seafood that already comes to the U.S., shrimp, crabs, lobster, in particular catfish as well. And that there are a lot of problems with the industrial aquaculture system in these countries and the way that they raise this seafood. So with shrimp, for instance, there's a high rate of salmonella amongst shrimp that's coming in. There is the problem of the fact that they're being raised basically in CAFOs in the sea, where a lot of shrimp, small area, in order to try to prevent them from getting sick, they're fed with a lot of chemicals, they're fed with a lot of antibiotics, and then they're also pumped up with other drugs to promote growth. And the next thing you know, we have shrimp coming into this country that have contaminated with drugs and pesticides that we aren't allowed to use in the U.S. Plus, at the same time, we don't have that many FDA inspectors on the border really inspecting these products coming in, and that is also a food safety issue.
I have two very specific questions about this, and go ahead very quickly, Darren, because I want to get to the phones and then come back to a couple of very specific questions.
Okay, yeah, there's a lot there. Just on the seafood safety issue, just recent CDC data, 2005, 2009, we looked at 100, let's see, there are CDC reported more than 100,000 illnesses from 2005 to 2009. About 2,348 were attributed to imported food. 141 of those attributed to imported seafood. Not one of those was attributed to farm-raised seafood at all. So kind of a little misleading on how dangerous this might be, the seafood. Also, just getting back to the catfish issue that was brought up, the Government Accountability Office which is not exactly an agency that you would think that doesn't exactly kind of particularly go after a particular program, has made it very clear that the catfish inspection and switching it from the Food Drug Administration that does seafood, switching it to the USDA, which does doesn't do seafood, would be a waste. And basically, their conclusion is that catfish is an extremely low-risk item, and there's no need to try to, you know, go switch from the FDA to the USDA for inspection. And that's the point, is there's a lot of scare tactics. There's really no risks that are being brought up or being addressed here. And certainly, food safety is certainly one conversation, but not necessarily part of the conversation as it relates to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This, once again, that's, again, it may be related, but ultimately Congress would have to amend any existing law.
I'm going to let Mitch come back. We only have a few minutes left, so I'm going to get to some things here that I think that our listeners at 410-319-8888. Allie, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just want one of your guests keeps going back to Congress being allowed to make the legislation in this country. That's exactly the problem with the fast track, is that it takes it out of Congress's hands, and that's exactly what the Obama administration is pushing for. So with fast track, it's going to go all straight to his desk for signature, and I agree with your guest that says that there's a lot of problems with it, and I'll take my answers off there.
Actually, this is Darren. Even with fast track, the whole point is that Congress is consulted throughout the process, and still Congress has to pass implementing legislation. So it's not like Congress is out of the process.
Well, you know, the Congress members I've spoken to have said that they are out of the process. Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro and Congressman George Miller.
Did they vote on the bill? Did they vote on legislation to implement it?
There hasn't been a vote on fast track yet.
I know.
They haven't been consulted. It hasn't been transparent. The text of the negotiated text has only recently been made available to them. It's not available to them at their office. They actually have to travel to the Department of Commerce if they want to read the text. They're not allowed to take notes. So to say that they're being included at this point is they're not allowed to take notes. So, you know, it's ridiculous to say that they're being consulted at this point. They're not. The fact of the matter is that the Obama administration has asked for fast-track trade authority, which means that they will have the authority to negotiate the trade deal and any other trade deals they want that fall under that authority, bring it to Congress, and Congress will have to give an up-and-down vote. They will not be allowed to amend the trade deal. So if Congress approves fast-track, then Allie is right. Then
right.
That's what will
right.
happen.
We don't have a few minutes left. Let me jump in and ask these questions that have just come in. A question came in. Will the TPP require us to import meat and poultry that do not meet U.S. food safety standards? And would the TPP abrogate food safety rules on pesticides, labeling, and additives that are higher than international standards? Would those happen in our country, Mitch?
Potentially, yes.
Why
yes.
potentially?
Well, because there's also being negotiated in here something called a rapid response mechanism, which would allow a corporation that is trying to bring a product into this country that was stopped at the border because of concerns about food safety to go to a kind of court to see if they can get the product moved into commerce while the testing that needs to take place is actually being done. So it is possible that under this rapid response mechanism component, that a product which is stopped at the border because an inspector actually believes there is a problem while the product is being tested could be forced into commerce. So that's a problem. And in terms of labeling, yes, the labels could be potentially challenged.
And very quickly again, because we only have like 3 minutes left, I want to get another caller in here from Joe. Darren?
Just on that previous question?
Yes.
Quite simply, in terms of whether or not we have to allow some product into this country, no, we don't have to. And getting back to ultimately, the fast track thing real quick, that's the big question. If Congress decides to approve fast track legislation, if they don't feel they're getting consulted, they won't, in fact, actually provide the fast track authority. So that's the whole point. And they won't if they don't think it's transparent enough.
We don't always have the greatest faith in what Congress might do or not do. We'll see how they react. Hopefully, they will do it in our interest.
No, but Congress is probably not going to be too happy, though, if they're not being consulted whatsoever.
So let me get a very quick call in here to end the show. Joe in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Joe.
Great, great, great show.
Thank you.
Much of this I did not know. I only have about two questions to make it easier for me to understand. It seems like, from what I've heard, there's about 70 years that have gone past, and yet, one gentleman is letting me know Congress has to do something. And what I need to know, since we've been talking about foods, arsenic in chicken, turkey, fish, rice, vegetables, all, basically our foods, how do we get, one, more information, and what do we look up to get that with? So that's part one. Two, who do we call or write to do something on our own behalf? Because I'm just really being awakened to so much being so wrong. And I need to, one, know more about it, and two, be able to respond to it. And three, if Congress is supposed to do it, just as they're doing now, they're shutting down things because there's a controversy between what the commander-in-chief says and his view on what the country should be doing and what Congress says and what mm-hmm. they want to be done. How do we, the people, get our voice back into the democracy to get something we want done?
Well, that is a great question. It's a huge question that I think we're going to have to tackle on the day. But what I can say is that if you go to thesteinershow.org, we will list the places where you can get information on the stuff that we're talking about. What I would encourage you to do when it comes to things like the what we've been talking about just now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, to your congressman is the first place to start.
Yes.
And your senators, let them know how you feel and think. We'll have all the information that we used as our study guides for this part of our program. We'll list those on steinershow.org. You can see those after 10 o'clock today. They'll all be there, and you can get the information there itself. And you can write me, Mark, at steinershow.org. Be glad to dialogue with you about that and think about how we can put this in that form on another show. I appreciate that call, Joe. And I'm sorry I took it at the very end of the hour so we couldn't get into it more deeply, which we should have. Let me thank both of our guests, Mitch Jones, director of the Common Resources Program at Food and Water Watch, and Darren Baxt, who is research fellow in agricultural policy at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to us here on The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. You listen to this production every week on Soundbites and The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Delmarva Public Radio. And glad you all could join us. Delmarva Public Radio, of course, 90.7 FM and 89.5 FM in the Delmarva Peninsula. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer, WEAA, is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear new additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download podcasts of The Mark Steiner Show on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM from Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.